The Gita, the word Gita means sangha. And the formal title of the Gita is the Upanishads, the ancient spiritual text sung by the Lord. They were sung for the benefit of people still fully involved and engaged in the world. The Upanishadic seekers of truth are calm, in a calm environment, as if they were in a scientific laboratory. The principles are discovered in a scientific laboratory, but then they have to be applied outside. We can study gravity best in an isolated environment, preferably with a vacuum. But then, and once the principle is established, we can see gravity at work, even in the autumn leaves, carried into the sky. Gravity is still at work there. And once the principle has been established, we're able to recognize it. In the same way, the spiritual truth is established in calmness, but it has to be recognized also in the tumult of life. Three of the Upanishadic scenes, they're calm. One of the oldest Upanishads is of a woman disciple. There was no prejudice against women in 600 BC. Maitreya often spoke about Brahma, about spiritual truth, about God, and inquired into it. And then when the time comes, she is offered the choice, great wealth or something else. She says, if I have great wealth, will it make me immortal? The teacher says, no, your life will be the life of any very wealthy person. She said, then tell me what will make me immortal, which you know. And then he says, and sit down, and what I teach, meditate on it. And in another Upanishad, the Upanishad of the questions, there are several of them who seek for the highest truth. They have studied truth, now they seek for the highest truth. And they hear of a great sage who can teach them. So they go to him, and he says, stay here with me for a year and practice meditation. Sanyam, technical word for entering samadhi, control of the senses, tapas, and brahmacharya. Then you can ask me questions and I'll answer. The third one, Prajapati, a great sage, he had a saying, there is a self free from death, free from grief. It is to be sought. When that is attained, all is attained. There's a little more, but that is the main. There's a self free from death, free from grief, which is to be sought after. When that is attained, all is attained. Then two, the king of the gods, Indra, the king of the demons, they hear this saying, and they come to the teacher. And they stay, he tells them to stay, and then they can ask the questions. And they stay and they perform service. Well, the word is translated service, as in the same way it's translated service in the Gita. But actually it means wanting to hear. They attend on the teacher wanting to hear that this about the self, free from death, free from grief, and how to attain it. It's not simply performing a service, but it's a service wanting to hear in search of truth. Well, in the same way in the Gita, the scene is a battlefield. And the hero is fully engaged in the affairs of the world, not like these calm seekers of the Upanishads. And he is asking, not about the highest truth, but which is the best for him to do, to fight or not to fight. So civil war and fighting will mean killing many of the people he knows and respects and reveres who are on the other side, and his own side also. He asks, which is best? Now, first of all, the teacher wants to find out whether this is just the depression which many soldiers feel just before an engagement. And they are brought out of it by what we would now call a pep talk about honor, about your duty to all the people to whom you're pledged, and so on. And the teacher presents these, but it has no effect. So this is no ordinary depression. This is a desire to find something much deeper than simply, is it better to win or to give way and become a renunciate? The teaching begins with reincarnation. The teacher says, well, this is a battle, many will die, but they cannot be killed. There is a great self in all, which puts on the bodies, as men put on clothes. When the bodies are worn out or destroyed, it puts on new ones. This is a very attractive teaching. One commentator has said, it's attractive and it's logical. He said, if it's presented well, you can believe it for half an hour. If it's a really good speaker, you believe it for half a month. And if it's a really brilliant exposition, you believe it for half a year. But after that, you start thinking, well, how do they know? The teaching is given, but it is not confirmed in the experience of the hearer. Then the teacher goes on, he describes the great self, but still there's no spark of experience awoken in the hearer. So then he describes the karma yoga, which is a yoga of action, not simply of realization. And the main point of the yoga of action, first presented, is to be able to act, as the quotation from our teacher said, to be able to act vigorously, but without fever, without elation if things go well, without fear of them going wrong, without depression if they do go wrong, to be able to act with the mind clear and serene and yet vigorously. And the Gita gives the first definition of this yoga when it says, it is evenness of mind, and this is skill in action. And Shankara comments that even in worldly affairs, if our mind is not even, we are not successful. Our actions, there may be some good result by chance, but our actions are not efficient. And our teacher used to give some humorous examples of how the clarity of the mind is upset and it becomes clouded by what he called silly personal dislike. Well, he may be a very famous doctor, but why should I do what he said? I didn't like him. What he called a silly dislike. Or, the ship can't be sinking, the captain's such a nice man. A silly personal attachment. There's no evenness of mind, and consequently, there's no clear vision. So the yoga is given. This is the first element of the yoga, the evenness of mind. And the second one is that the mind in meditation should be brought to stillness. The example is given later on, like a steady burning flame in a windless place, burning steadily without any interruption or flickering. Then this yoga is given for people who can't see, who can't get a glimpse of the self, of the great self which is declared first. Then in chapter 3, the teacher develops this further. He explains that for those who can catch a glimpse of the great self, then the means is to make that continuous and free from obstruction. But to those who can't, they have to perform the actions with the mind serene. They have to practice indifference to the opposites of good and bad as they seem to us, and pain and pleasure and heat and cold. And then he says you will not be able to do this unless you practice yoga meditation. He tells Arjun, you will not be able to control the senses unless you practice yoga meditation. You won't be able to control your thoughts unless you practice meditation. And this is repeated again in the 18th chapter, which says that without the yoga meditation, you can control sometimes the thoughts and the feelings, but not invariably. Well, then he speaks once of a devotion to the self manifesting as an external lord. But it's only one reference in chapter 3. And we can note that although the teacher Krishna is teaching, and Arjun is supposed to be accepting this, Arjun has his doubts. Because one of the things at the end of chapter 2, he asks, what is a man like who has control over his mind and whose knowledge is beginning to become steady? How does he talk? How does he sit? How does he move? Well, he has an example right in front of him. If you are sitting with a famous judge, you don't say to him, do judges at tea time constantly sort of give arbitrary decisions or niggle over small points? You have an example. You're sitting with the judge. So he has certain reservations, and these reservations come to a head at the end of the chapter and the beginning of the next chapter. The Gita should end at the end of chapter 3. Krishna says, I have told you now the highest secret. The highest secret. And then Arjun does not believe it. Krishna says, I've told you this great secret which I taught at the very beginning of creation. And Arjuna says, how could you have taught it at the beginning of creation? You're here now. Which shows that he didn't believe what he was told, that the great self never dies, that it takes on the different bodies. So then the Gita goes on. And other instruction is given, though all pointing in the same direction. Well, we can say, well, it seems odd to be told that there's this highest secret, and then the Gita goes on after the highest secret, and this is going to come again and again. The Gita will say in chapter 7, now I'm going to tell you the great knowledge beyond which there's nothing more to be known. But again, in chapter 15, he will say, now I will give you the great knowledge, the great secret. And in chapter 18, at the end, he said, now I will tell you the great secret of all. But he's already told him the highest secret. Well, how can we make sense of this, as Arjun says? And Shankara says, this is not simply a question of Arjun individually. He is speaking for all the future generations who listen to the truth and who feel that in a way they believe it but have interior reservations. So the Gita then continues. The great self was announced first, unmanifest, beyond cause and effect, beyond thought, unchangeable, indestructible. This was announced first of all. Only when it was not, it didn't strike this spark of realization in Arjuna, then the karma yoga was given of how to act in evenness of mind and how to practice formal meditation at fixed times and bring the mind to stillness. Then Arjuna makes his objection. How can you have taught this? He doesn't believe the great self, and then Krishna gives the first example of the great self assuming an illusory form like the rest of the great world illusion. He says, I am born again and again to declare the truth whenever there's a need for it. And the word is yuge yuge. It means literally age after age, but yuga can also mean a junction. In fact, the words have the same root. And one teacher has said that this can apply to the junctions in life. When we come to a great difficulty or a terrible disappointment, this is like a joint, a junction in life. It says at these times of extreme difficulty or crisis, then the Lord appears, if he can be recognized. And he says that the Chinese give an example that a bamboo has this smooth extent here, and then there's a knot, and then there's another smooth period. But the new branches can only grow from the knots, can't grow from the smooth part. So it's there's a Chinese teaching that when your life is very smooth and comfortable and easy, it may go quite well, but nothing new will come out of that. But it's in the knots of life, the disappointments, the breaking of some long-held belief or habit or reliance. It's from that knot that the new spiritual branch can appear, the new spiritual life appears. Well, then in chapter 5, again, the two paths are mentioned. There's a path of realization, which begins with a glimpse of the self, of the knowledge of the self. He says this again and again. The path of knowledge is for those who have realized the self. And the path is to remove the obstructions and distractions from that realization. Or there is the path of yoga, of karma yoga, which consists in the evenness of mind in action, which means being able to give up the reliance and hopes and fears on the results or the motives of action. Well, then the chapters, end of chapter 5 and chapter 6, are on the formal meditation. And careful instructions are given how to sit. We, the Eastern tradition says that in the West, people don't actually know how to think. There is no, they have no way of thinking, and they're thinking hard. Einstein used to twirl a lock of hair, and if you look at the most famous picture of the thinker, it's Rodin's thinker, whose elbow is on the other opposite knee, and the fist is pushing into the face, so it distorts the mouth, and they say. You compare this with the Buddha statues. This is one who knows how to think deeply. We can think effectively, superficially, but they have learned how to think more deeply. Well, this instruction is given to Arjuna, but he doesn't, he's not able to actualize it. And he says, frankly, it's impossible. You can't bring the mind to a stop. And here again, as Shankara has pointed out, he speaks for the people, for follow? And Krishna said, impossible, difficult, but by regular practice, abhyasa, means practice at regular times, long continued, then it can be done. But Arjuna still isn't convinced at all. And he does something which all teachers of all subjects know. When there's a sort of will to fail, he says, well, what happens if I don't manage to pull it off? I'll have wasted a lot of time, won't I? And I won't have got that. And then there's all the things in the world I might have been doing and I won't have done them either. Teachers all know this. And Krishna meets it patiently and he says, well, if you make great efforts, you will set forward going a dynamism which will carry you forward, if necessary, into new births. And then he passes on to chapter 7, after Arjuna's disbelief in chapter 6, and a new method is opened up. And this is a method of devotion to God as the universal. The Gita is universal. It doesn't recommend any cult of an avatar or some great figure or of the teacher, the personality of the teacher. There is nothing like this. Krishna hardly mentions himself at all, and no characteristics are given to worship. It doesn't. Our teacher said that to the worship of a great avatar or a great saint is one of the spiritual methods. But in this Gita text, it's universal, and the descriptions of the Lord given for devotion are universal. But we're expected to go into them deeply, not just think, oh, how beautiful, and then pass on. The verses have a depth in them which we can penetrate. Now, for instance, there's one verse which is translated by our teacher.
There is nothing beyond God. All this exists and receives its support from Him, like the beads on a thread. He is both the material and the efficient cause of the universe.
Well, this is a beautiful example to think of pearls on a string. The Lord, invisible, penetrating the universe. And then people say, yes, but then that's a sort of get out, isn't it? It's invisible. The example is chosen of something that's invisible. How do we know it's there? You can see the beads, but it's exactly the string that you can't see. And it's into this sort of example that we're expected to penetrate. Now, in one way, we do perceive the thread. And we're quite aware of the thread, because if it wasn't there, the pearls would scatter. And if we penetrate this deeply enough, we would see that the universe would scatter. There would be no order in the universe without this invisible thread of intelligence holding it together. Sridhara, who was the teacher of our teacher and not a learned man, he was asked this point once, and he answered in two sentences. He said, well, what maintains the order in the universe? And the skeptical objector said, well, it's the laws of nature, of course. And Sridhara said, were those laws there before the universe? Or did they come afterwards? Now, Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize winner, he asks this very point. He makes this same point in his book, The Laws of Physics. He says, what physics has to inquire into is whether the laws of nature were there before or came after, and why these laws of nature and no others. And it's now being studied and being investigated that the laws are peculiarly favourable for human life. Well, then the devotion continues. That the path of devotion continues. That the Lord is seen sometimes as the most beautiful, the most powerful, the most glorious, the most profound of things. He's most easily meditated on. It's true. Krishna is given as an example. Krishna in the tribe of Rishni, but then he says, of warriors, I'm Rama, another incarnation. And he says, of the Pandavas, that's Arjuna's clan, I am Arjuna. So he gives, there's no personality expressed. It's a universal manifestation in the different places. And Arjuna is very convinced by this, by the beauty and the power of the exposition. And he says at the end of chapter 10, well, now I have understood. Now my delusion is gone. And he thinks that he has realization because he thinks it is a wonderful and elevating idea. And the Lord then shows him one of his forms. And Arjuna finds that his whole idea collapses. And the reason it collapses is given in the Gita, because he hasn't in fact cleared his mind of all the prejudices and preconceptions which he has. And he, when he sees in the universal form his enemy, Karuna, he makes a derogatory comment, even at that moment of divine vision. He doesn't see the Lord in Karuna. He only sees a contemptible enemy. So he's unable to bear the vision, and the Lord withdraws it. And there's an important hint in chapter 8, which is on the strength of yoga. And the Lord says, by practicing repeatedly, your yoga will attain strength. We say, well, what does it mean? Well, ideas can be exalting and wonderful and inspiring, but if they have no strength, they are liable to change and collapse. And one Buddhist priest in the Far East, he said, you know, people come on the day of the worship, and they come along the street. I see them talking, and a couple of them are talking, and then when they come to the gate, the tradition is they come onto the stepping stones into the peace of the temple. They're absolutely silent. And they come. And they take part in the service with great devotion and reverence, and they go out silently and calmly. He said, and the moment they're outside the gate, one says, and another thing. He says, yes, they have been devout, but it had no strength. So that the meditation has to be pursued until it is what the technical term of Shankara, ripened, matured, paripaka. It's one of his terms in his Gita commentary. It has to be matured by long practice, and it has to be continued outside the meditation period. Well, the after the vision, there is a teaching of devotion. And it changes again. And we can think, well, what are all these new secrets and teachings which are given? And one example is given is this, that the yoga teaching is not a question of ordinary teaching, where you teach first of all the alphabet, and then on that you build sentences, and then on the sentences you build more difficult sentences, and then you learn something about style, where each one depends on the one below. And it's not like that, because it's not a question of building up something, but it's a question of removing an illusion. And one of the teachers says it's much easier to get rid of a burglar than a ghost. Because you can call in your friends, if you think there's a burglar, and they come and they search the whole house. And then you lock and you bar it and you know there's no burglar there. But if it's a ghost, they come in and they search the whole house, no ghost there. And they go away and there he is. The removal of the illusion is more difficult than the removal of an actual fact. And it's done in various ways. Now, one example that's given is somebody who's been brought up under a tyranny where if you speak your mind, you're liable to be put in prison. The cults in Eastern Europe are an example. Anyone who spoke out against the destruction was going on, anyone who refused to stand up and cheer when President Ceausescu announced the latest absolutely disastrous figures was put in prison or shot. Now, if you come from that to a free country, now some of them came out, especially if they were young and rather nervous. And especially if nothing had ever actually happened to them, but they'd heard of awful things happening to other people. Then coming to a free country, sometimes, there was a case I came to know of a girl. She had difficulty in expressing a free opinion about anything political at all, or local government, even the desirability of a zebra crossing or something there. And she knew she was absolutely free. But she couldn't help feeling that if she were to say anything, something awful might happen. But she knew it wouldn't. Well, now they tried to get her out of this, and they tried in various ways. One of them said, well, look, we'll go for a walk in the park. There are no microphones hidden there, are they? And you can speak your mind frankly there. Just say it, just to me. There'll be only me there, but you'll get the idea of being able to say, look, it's a scandal that they haven't put a zebra crossing there. But she went there and she did it, but she was in a terrible state of tension. So then they tried something else. They said, well, look, they got a newspaper article critical of a similar point, you see. And they said, now look, you read this aloud. It won't be your opinion, you see. So you won't be responsible for that. You're just reading what's in the newspaper. Well, she managed to get through that a little bit. And they tried in various other ways. And gradually she became free of this imaginary, of this illusion, which was obstructing her power of speech. Well, now the things weren't building up on each other, but they were different methods that they tried. So that the methods of the Gita are not building up on each other, but they're trying different methods to see which one will register, so to speak, with Arjuna and begin to set him free. The very end of the Gita, the Lord says, now I'll tell you the highest secret of all. And Shankara says, this is for one who momentarily is prepared to be completely free. It says, give up even your virtuous deeds and go to me alone. And Shankara says it means come into me. The phrase is my being. And our teacher repeatedly cited this. It comes in the Gita 5 times in key places. 4, 10, 8, 5. My being, you will become, our teacher translated it, you will become what I am. The individual self, the essence of that self, will be revealed, will experience self as the Lord. And it says, give up everything, even virtue, even the consciousness of doing good. Just momentarily give it up and jump. Now, we can say, well, one would like to. There's one teacher, he used to use this phrase, give it up. And somebody with a persistent illness was one of his disciples, or came occasionally. And they were going to do a period of a few days, rather severe discipline. And this man said, well, you know, I don't know whether I'll be able to go through with this because of my, And the teacher said, oh, give it up. And the man blazed up. He said, I wish I could give it up. I can't give it up. And the teacher said, yes, you can give it up. He said, what do you mean? This is a terrible burden for me. The teacher said, no, you can take sensible measures, but the point is this, it's your dearest treasure. People talk about their dearest treasure all the time, and you're talking about that all the time. It's your dearest treasure, you feel it's me, don't you? Now, give it up. Well, our teacher used to put it in a story which he told with great enthusiasm of a poor Brahmin poet who presented some poems to one of the richest Muslim princes of India. And the Muslim prince, who was a very cultured man, realized these poems were masterpieces. And he ordered the chamberlain to pile up some silver in front of the Brahmin and then take it away. But the Brahmin said, no, it is our custom that when a gift is made, the donor, the giver himself, should present it. So a Muslim prince said, well, I'm Muslim, I can't possibly come down there and present this money to you, these piles of silver. And the Brahmin said, then I won't take it. And the prince said, think well, Brahmin. Where will you find another patron as generous as this? And the Brahmin looked at these piles of silver. He said, and where will you find a man as independent as this? And he gave a great kick and walked out. Well, our teacher used to, he gave this example. And one of the things he said was that even the most spiritual people at the end of their lives are disappointed. Their inner self is free, but they have made plans, and those plans have been for the good of the people, and those plans have been at least temporarily frustrated. And he said, and this is a chance for them to make a final gesture of complete independence and to give the world and its values a great kick. Well, the Gita ends with that. Giving up even your righteous deeds. What to say of the unrighteous ones? Go to me alone. I will free you from all these things. Do not grieve. Well, thank you for your attention. Thank you.